Good morning and welcome to the breakdown with Brooks and Bronder on K-12 Leaders, where we do a readout of the day's education news and dive into stories that we think matter to you, the educator. I'm Mike Bronder, and with me is Ms. Brooks. Good morning, Ms. Brooks.
Good morning, Michael. I'm so excited. I've been waiting to have Monday roll around just for this reason.
That's excellent. And what's come across your desk over the weekend, Susie?
Oh, it's funny. One of the ones that jumped right out at me was something from Jordan Pierce Robinson from eSchool News talking about enhancing classroom learning with interactive maps. I know as a teacher that teaching with maps was always something that my students were very much into. They find them very engaging, and it talks about how most teachers will tell you it's as part of post-COVID world, technology is an everyday part of education, and it has undeniably transformed the way that educators engage students and deliver content. And so this article will talk about how you can enhance learning with interactive maps. So it's one to check out, I am sure. What about you? Which one jumped out at you right away?
Well, another one right near that story, Susie, is about simplifying AI for educators from tech and learning. The first thing they start off talking about is how big data was all the rage not that long ago, but that has certainly turned to AI over the last 12 months or so. And they have a nice condensed sort of guide to keeping AI simple and relevant for teachers.
Awesome. There's so much out there about AI right now. It feels like it's already too big.
It's true.
It's very true. I can't keep up. We do have a colleague though has written a book recently that readers might want to check out. And I believe he's just put it out. He has it here on K-12 Leaders, right,
That's
Mike?
right. Yeah, Carl
Carl
Hooker
Hooker.
and the Learning Evolution. You can learn more about that on k12leaders.com. And we also have at k12leaders.com/breakdown 6 trends to watch in K-12 schools for 2024 by none other than Michael B. Horn. And we'll do a quick overview of that one for you. But you can find a link to this article on eSchool News, and we have a link on k12leaders.com/the breakdown. And as new calendar year gets underway, new initiatives and trends will emerge to impact teaching and learning. So this post originally appeared in the Christensen Institute's blog and is reprinted by eSchool News. The key points are that teaching trends will impact K-12 learning in a myriad of ways this year. Student engagement requires more than just education technology. Insights from educators and priorities from 2023 and 2024 are outlined. And there are additional trends on eSchool News Innovative Teaching Hub. So I'd encourage you to check all of those out. But as far as Michael Horn's 6 top trends, there's a theme here, the rise of homeschooling. It's not new to note that homeschooling has grown significantly over the last few years since the start of the pandemic and has diversified even more. Even mainstream media has picked up on the trend and called it the fastest growing segment of schooling. Michael Horn's read is slightly different. The news should be that the growth in homeschooling from the pandemic is proving much stickier than people originally expected it to be. But the breakneck growth has slowed. It may even be declining. The second trend is a focus on parent power. The bigger trend is that parents are feeling much more empowered to make choices about their children's education. Not only are they choosing homeschooling, but more families are also choosing other alternative forms of schooling, such as private schools, charter schools, virtual schools, micro schools, and a variety of hybrid homeschooling arrangements. Parents are also exerting themselves within schools by advocating for changes in curriculum and instruction. But broadly speaking, this parent power movement is creating a flourish of different schooling arrangements as parents want to ensure their children make progress in their development. Third trend is education savings accounts, and that's related to the parent power trend, with 13 states now having such policies. ESAs are not vouchers. They're a much deeper form of supporting educational choice in which the state funds a savings account and a family is allowed to spend the dollars in that account on a wide range of educational goods and services. That's different from a voucher, which is essentially a ticket for one kind of educational service, a school, and you either use it or lose it. With an ESA, there's an incentive for a family to shop for value and save money until they find the right service for their child. The fourth trend that he notes is that there are challenges for traditional school districts, which shouldn't be much of a surprise after realizing that there is so much competition and challenge to the traditional structure. Many traditional school districts are continuing to struggle given this context. They've lost students, particularly in urban and high poverty districts, to other schools. They've shrunk because there are fewer students thanks to a broader demographic decline in new births. And they've struggled with chronic absenteeism. What's behind many of these struggles is a one-size-fits-all mindset that clashes with education pluralism and parents' more active desires for customized support. A fifth trend is a portrait of a graduate and rethinking assessment. And this is something that I've seen in a number of our conversations. Susie, you and I had a couple of conversations about this last week with a couple of interesting organizations. An increasing number of states have moved to create portraits of a graduate, what they believe students should know and be able to do upon graduation. These measures are much broader than just the standards underlying required graduation requirements, but they also, to this point, are largely aspirational. They aren't backed by assessments that verify a student has mastered the competencies underlying such portraits. That's part of what's creating a window for rethinking assessment more broadly. The Carnegie Foundation, and in partnership with ETS, New Meridian, Schoolhouse.World, and others are seeking to take advantage. Michael Horn hopes that this movement will open a larger window for mastery-based or competency-based learning. Then CTE for all is the final trend that he outlines here on eSchool News. There is a growing realization that the College for All movement of the last several decades has not served all students well. Many students who start bachelor's degree programs don't complete them, and when they leave college with student debt, the outcome can be horrendous. I would encourage you to check out this full article, either on eschoolnews.com, or you can find a link to that on k12leaders.com/the breakdown. But there's some good trends that he's outlining here. Susie,
That's
back to
all
you.
awesome. Thank you. I actually checked that one out myself. There were so many articles that caught my eye. Another one that I haven't fully read, although while you were reading, I took a quick peek at, is Fifth Time's the Charm for Sex Ed Law. And it says the state, are you laughing?
No, I
The
thought you were looking at
state.
a different article, I swear.
The state dragged its sex education guidelines into the new millennium last year, updating health frameworks for pre-K through 12th grade students to include modern language on sexuality and consent. And I found it to be interesting only because my son-in-law is a health and PE teacher. So I did a quick peek at the article. I'm not going to read the whole thing for you because I have others that I'm going to read instead. And I was surprised to find that it was Massachusetts. So another, local story here, and it's talking about some of the frameworks that we're trying to improve and update when it comes to including modern language on sexuality and consent. And so if you're looking to read a little bit more, it's posted on the 74, but I believe it's also from the Commonwealth Beacon. You can read more by visiting K-12 Leaders slash the breakdown, or excuse me, breakdown, and you can read more about it there. But one that I wanted to go into a little bit more deeply today was, oh, and I'll save that one for later. No, that's my grand finale. Was doing educational equity right and the homework gap. So this is a story that came out of Education Next, and it's written by Michael J. Petrilli, sorry if I butchered your name. The question is not whether students should do homework, but how to help them do more. And this is actually the sixth in a series of doing educational equity right. There's others on school finance, student discipline, advanced education, and school closures. The casual observer might be surprised that there's much controversy about homework. A common sense man on the street view would be straightforward. Teachers should assign homework, and students should do it. After all, practice makes perfect, and kids can't learn without exerting effort. But alas, in this domain, as in others, there is indeed robust debate, and not just among belly-aching students. Some of it springs from hothouse schools in upper-middle-class suburbs, where parents fret that too much homework is stressing out their sons and daughters. Some of it stems from scholars who have questioned whether homework actually boosts learning. But much of it comes from concerns about the homework gap. The long-standing finding that kids from low-income households spend significantly less time on homework than their more advantaged peers, and therefore, some argue we should limit homework or eliminate it altogether. And they do include some statistics on the average hours spent doing homework by student poverty level from 2019. And the author goes on to say, "You won't be surprised that I disagree, that certainly there is no way to do education equity right." And so he said, instead of leveling down, Harrison Bergeron style, we should level up. Our goal when it comes to homework should be to get more students to do it and more of it, at least the valuable, productive kind, which loads of research studies demonstrate is related to increased academic achievement. And that means addressing the barriers that some low-income students face when it comes to doing homework, either at home or at school. The most obvious one relates to technology. Though the digital divide has largely been closed, low-income families are still likely to have high-speed internet across in their access in their homes. And while schools dramatically ramped up their one-to-one laptop initiatives during the pandemic, there are still locales where not all students have access to workable devices. As reported by Education Week, a recent Pew survey found that 22% of US teens said that they often or sometimes have to do their homework on a cell phone. 12% said that at least sometimes they are unable to complete homework assignments because they do not have reliable access to a computer or internet connection. And 6% said that they have to use public Wi-Fi to do their homework at least sometimes because they don't have an internet connection at home. To the extent that schools are assigning homework that must be done online, that's an issue. Low-income students are also less likely to report having a quiet place to do homework, not surprising given that their homes tend to be smaller and that they often are tasked with taking care of younger siblings. Their parents may also be less capable of helping with homework, given that within lower income families, parents and other caregivers are much more likely to have dropped out of high school themselves. But the answer to these challenges can't be simply to throw up our hands and say it's unfair to assign homework to kids from low-income families, so we just won't assign any homework to anyone. It's to overcome the challenges. That entails addressing the technology gap, such as providing laptops or Chromebooks to all students, as well as Wi-Fi hotspots. An even better approach might be to make such technology available at the school by keeping media centers open and staffed before school, after school, and on the weekends. That turns homework into out-of-class work. But the benefits are the same. The marginal costs of keeping public school facilities open longer are minimal, but the benefits could be substantial. If that creates new challenges, for example, providing transportation to students for these extended learning time opportunities, then study halls and the like could be built into the regular school day itself. Just make the day longer and adjust the transportation schedule accordingly, or team up with other community organizations that could provide homework help and quiet environments from public libraries to Boys and Girls Clubs to churches. None of this is rocket science. Indeed, KIPP charter schools have been doing versions of this for a quarter century, including giving students their teachers' cell phone numbers so that they can get help with homework at night. That's because KIPP and other great high poverty schools have always felt a sense of urgency around helping their students catch up to their more affluent peers. And they've always known that means working harder and longer, not just to close the homework gap, but to reverse it. I know what some might be saying. Getting traditional public schools to do things like this is going to be hard. Chromebooks and Wi-Fi hotspots cost money, and so does keeping school libraries open after school or on weekends. Not all teachers will be crazy about giving kids access to their phone numbers. All true, But if we care about doing educational equity right, we need to call the bluff of those who want to lower expectations for students' work and effort because equity. Those so-called advocates need to do some of their own homework and penance as well. So lots of thoughts on homework. Doesn't really mention any age levels. I'm assuming that they're talking about high school. Is my guess, but some things to think about. And definitely, if you have some thoughts on that, the best place to go is off to k12leaders.com, where you can weigh in on this and any of the articles that we read. Any thoughts on that one, Michael?
Well, it's interesting, Susie, how that wraps up. I can't off the top of my head cite the exact examples, but there was a trend last week in a couple of articles talking about equity through the lens, equity with a positive lens on assessments, and that assessments actually raise the bar for students. I think that there's it'll be interesting as we continue this project to see what trends sort of evolve week over week. But that one certainly overlapped. Good. Thank you for that.
You're
A
welcome.
couple of other interesting headlines this week that you can find on k12leaders.com. A multi-state coalition for challenges residency requirements for public schools. That's in the 74, and you can find that on k12leaders.com/breakdown. We also have some details again from the 74 linked on k12leaders.com/breakdown for the governor's 2024 education priorities, where early childhood curriculum, school choice, and mental health are all getting funding in over 38 states. And additionally, let's see. So you had done something from the Learning Network earlier this episode, Susie, and I think that it's a great resource. And we were laughing earlier about this piece that got put up, and this is a student piece about leveraging TikTok in the classroom. And it asks a simple question: what's your favorite kind of TikTok video? And it goes into some depth about the trick shot type video where folks will throw a card at a wall to see if they can get it to stick, or tossing Cheetos in the air and catching them in a water bottle. But some great ideas in that Learning Network article.
Oh, that cracks me up. Of course, I don't know anything about those because I'm not on TikTok, Michael.
Good for you. You have way more time on your hands than I do, because boy, am I busy. And then a couple of other, Education Next, again, they have an article here on living and dying in LA, USD. Those are charters in trouble, and referencing the 1985 film To Live and Die in LA with theme song by Wang Chung. Outline some of the struggles that LAUSD charters are having. It's interesting. While Michael Horn just a minute ago mentions that all of these alternative education frameworks are gaining a lot of attention, we also have a lot of challenges to the traditional charter networks as well. So, I'm going to go in on one more article here, Susie, from West Virginia. And again, this sort of sticks with that theme. But this is, again, it's from the 74. And if you guys aren't familiar with the 74million.org, fantastic resource. We read a lot of articles from them. And this one is by Linda Jacobson. A failed West Virginia micro school fuels state probe and some soul searching. So while this is a trend, these micro schools and education savings account are a trend, it is by no means a slam dunk. In August, Kelly Romanishin thought she'd found the right school for her son, an innovative startup in a rented two-story house that promised STEM lessons, art activities, and the necessary tools to take on the world. The West Virginia mom paid the operator a $2,200 advance from her HOPE scholarship, an education savings account that gives families state funds for tuition or homeschooling expenses. But events at the Hive Learning Academy quickly unraveled. Instead of structured mealtimes, children just grabbed lunch from the refrigerator when they got hungry. Her son would come home starving because he was too shy to just go into someone else's fridge, Ramanesh said. Kathy Daly, who enrolled her 13-year-old son there, had a similar experience. When she visited the school in the eastern panhandle town of Martinsburg, students were just hanging out, buried in their phones, she says. An exasperated Ramanesh said that she soon realized that the Hive was actually just a glorified babysitter. This is from the 74. You can find this link at k12leaders.com/breakdown. By Christmas, they'd joined several parents demanding their money back and scrambling to find other arrangements. Inquiries that prompted Republican State Treasurer Riley Moore to include the school in an ongoing audit and investigation into ESA-funded programs, the official said. The probe is believed to be the first government investigation anywhere into self-identified micro schools, providing an awkward milestone for a movement that mushroomed during the pandemic and now includes 125,000 schools nationwide, according to the National Micro Schooling Center. Hailed by Republicans and fueled by the spread of ESAs, micro schools operate out of homes, storefronts, and churches with a degree of freedom from government oversight. But the West Virginia episode shows that managing the freedom while maintaining public accountability can be a tricky balancing act, even for the movement's fiercest advocates. We're in a transitional market, said Jamie Buckland, who runs West Virginia Families United for Education, a nonprofit that advises both parents and vendors in the sector. She thinks states with ESAs should do a better job preparing school founders and helping families navigate their options. We don't want the government to provide the guardrails and the parameters, she asked. I'm sorry. If we don't want the government to provide the guardrails and the parameters, she asked, what is our movement doing to provide our own guardrails? Acknowledging they'd received allegations of specific Hope scholarship violations, the treasurer's office, which runs the ESA program, would not comment on the scope of the investigation or when it would be completed. In a November email shared with the 74, an assistant treasurer told Ramanishan that the office was considering the potential involvement of law enforcement if appropriate, but has yet to bring charges. We tried our best. Zimmerman thought so too. The homeschooling mother opened the Hive with co-founder Kristen Volpe to give her own three children more opportunities to make friends. She rented the space, hung maps on the walls, and culled curriculum materials from her favorite homeschooling programs. When 30 families registered last summer, she had high expectations. To help get started, she asked parents in August to pay the bulk of their tuition up front, roughly $2,000 to $4,000 per student. But she had to dip into her own money to pay for furniture and supplies, and when fall came, only eight students showed up. She said she and Volpe never intended to avoid our responsibilities. With far less revenue than expected, they didn't have enough to cover costs and pay themselves. To save money, Zimmerman moved out of the home she was renting and into a second floor of the micro school location. She and Volpe took jobs at Macy's warehouse to pay bills, and Zimmerman began bartending a few nights a week. But juggling multiple jobs made for a hit-or-miss schedule for students. It was a fun environment, she said, but there wasn't any homework or a set curriculum. Their downfall, Zimmerman said, was a lack of startup cash. And when she realized she couldn't keep the program going, Zimmerman said she asked the state officials how to return the ESA funds, but didn't receive a lot of guidance. It was very stressful and upsetting for us, she said. We're just two working class mothers with a great idea, but no means to make it happen. But it does take more than good intentions to run a quality program, said Rochelle Noble, founder of Micro School Solutions, an Arizona-based consulting firm. Formerly with Prenda, a micro school no network, Noble was in charge of the model's growth. 2 years ago, she made what she described as a tough decision to close two programs that operated with a Kansas school district virtual program. The reality is that many new micro schools don't last beyond the first year, said Amar Kumar, CEO of Kaipod Learning, another micro school network. And it's the same as with any small business or startup. The chances of failure are very high, he said. Involvement of public money in the form of ESAs raises the stakes. After the Hive ordeal, Zimmerman said she still loves the concept of microschools, but she doubts she'll try to open another one. It requires way more resources and business knowledge than most regular working class people and parents have. So the article concludes that that's why some critics don't think public funds should support them. Chris Stewart, CEO of Brightbeam, an education advocacy network, once considered himself an ESA evangelist and hoped they'd provide better educational options. While it's unclear if any of their businesses operated as microschools, a woman from Maricopa County, Arizona, who was in, I'm sorry, Maricopa County, Arizona. I'm sorry. Last year, for example, the grand jury in Maricopa County, Arizona, indicted three women accused of fraud and theft of over $87,000 in connection with that state's ESA program. While it's unclear if any of their businesses operated as microschools, the women allegedly created educational receipts and claimed reimbursement for bogus services. Some parents do an inordinate amount of due diligence, said Noble, with microschool solutions, but others, she said, sign up kids and haven't even seen the space. Advocates for microschools believe that the market will eventually weed out fraud and low quality options. I feel like I failed my son, Romanishin said. I should have read the flags. So, another very in-depth article from the 74, Susie. Talking about one side of the story around these educational savings accounts, parent empowerment, and challenges to the traditional public education. And you can find that either on educationnext.org or a link to that story on k12leaders.com/the breakdown.
It's a great share. I don't think I had ever heard of micro schools before, so it was a great entry level article for me to listen to. Thanks for sharing that, Michael. That's awesome. As I was looking through, it's funny that you keep mentioning the learning network. Today's word of the day is chronology. I know I've been fussing with some of them, with some of the pronunciations this week, but there's been mentioned on 65 different articles in the New York Times in the past year. And let's see, I know that I was hoping this week also, not this week, but today, to be able to highlight one more article, but I had just sent you article from the 74 that I thought maybe you would want to highlight, Michael. Did you just get that link
Let's
on
see.
your
Where am I supposed to see that, Susie?
Zoom?
Oh, on my Zoom.
Yes.
This is again, this is interesting and on trend with a lot of other stories. Again, from the 74million.org. If you all haven't subscribed to the 74 million, I'd absolutely endorse that decision. It's a free resource, and they do some really great in-depth reporting on education. And this article, Susie, is about Congress's, this is an opinion piece that Congress must pass Kids Online Safety Act to make social media safe for youth. The Okolo bill would protect kids' personal information, turn off addictive product features, and require companies to minimize health risks. This is absolutely worth a deep read. And I would, it is linked on k12leaders.com. It's highlighting a lot of the behaviors of traditional social media that we're working against here at K-12 Leaders, particularly this, the addiction to scrolling. But this is an opinion piece, and I'll give it a quick read. It's by Zainab Okolo. On January 31st, the Senate Judiciary Committee held a hearing to address the dangers young people experience when navigating social media platforms. The emotionally charged event drew a diverse audience, featuring heart-wrenching stories that underscored the severe impact of online bullying, harassment, and specifically sexual exploitation on children's mental health and safety. Senators questioned social media executives on what, if any, steps they would commit to taking to protect young users on their platforms. The Jed Foundation. At the Jed Foundation, we advocate for a safety-first approach, aligning with the Surgeon General's advisory on social media and youth mental health. We know young people find community online. What we're hoping is that they find safe communities, and it's time to insist that platforms prioritize children's safety. That's why Jed has endorsed the Kids Online Safety Act, which requires social media platforms to protect young users by enabling them to protect their personal information, turn off addictive product features, and opt out of receiving recommendations made by algorithms. And I'm going to interject there, Susie's, like, even with youth that I'm familiar with, they reject, the risk. They understand that these properties are collecting PII, and they don't care. They think that it's worth it for
Yeah,
the main hit.
they do.
So that's
They're willing to give up their privacy for attention. I agree with you. I think it's a great article to check out later. The length of it is not too bad to dive into, and I thought it might be something that you'd want to highlight.
Yeah, no, absolutely. And it's not just youth, right? I mean, again, I think that the work that we're doing here at K-12 Leaders is really parallel to this kind of effort for teachers and educators and staff and administrators, creating an environment that's productive and safe and eliminates a lot of the noise, the trolls, the spam. Not to turn this into a commercial for K-12 Leaders, but this is a significant issue, and we'd love to have your voices here on K-12 Leaders to continue this respectful dialogue.
Right. Yep. You can find like and unlike minds to have those discussions with
Right.
in a safe environment, like you said. Absolutely. Did you want to continue it or do you want to leave
I
it
think
hanging?
that's it
We'll
for this
pick it up.
morning, Susie. And I want to thank you for your attention and your voice in all of this, and would welcome all of our listeners to join us on k12leaders.com/thebreakdown.
Awesome. I'm so glad everyone could tune in. I did have one more if you
Oh yes,
wanted to.
absolutely.
I had one more that I wanted to share. I
I
just
was
had
hoping you're going to get to this one, Susie.
to. Well, I was checking out our feed this morning and on Tech and Learning, I believe Eric Ofgang has had an article that I've read out before, but this one I couldn't resist, and it's 5 reasons to teach with Taylor Swift. So please don't shut off our podcast this morning. I'm not a Swiftie. I am the mother of one, but I find this to be a really interesting article to share. And yes, there are a lot of Taylor euphemisms. I think I have the word right in the article, but I'm going to go ahead and share it with you anyway because I think there's some great ideas.
And
It says
even
we don't.
before you read it, Susie, I will say that I am a Swiftie,
No
unashamed.
shame, no shame. We don't know about you, but the advice for teaching with Taylor Swift has us feeling 22. Teaching with Taylor Swift can be a great way to create lessons and help build connections to material that students won't ever. Oh, hang on. I'm so excited. I can't even see straight. I'm going to make the print a little bigger.
Taylor Swift does that to someone.
Oh, I'm so crazy. Teaching with Taylor Swift can be a great way to create lessons and to help build connections to material that students won't ever want to, shake off, says Misty L. Hagerness, an economics professor and scientist at the University of Kansas. Hagerness recently created Swiftonomics 101, a free online course. This short course is designed to be used by teachers with their students in various subjects and examine Swift's success and her relationship with recent Super Bowl champion NFL star Travis Kelce through an economics lens that seemingly does the impossible, makes economic theory relatable to everyone. Hegness is also writing a book called Swiftonomics, which will explore similar topics. Hegness shares tips and suggestions for how teachers can incorporate this course and why they should consider using Swift's popularity as a jumping off point for other subjects. If you take this advice, you can be a hero in your classroom, which is a good thing because we all know how exhausting it is, always rooting for the anti-hero. So it says, teaching with Taylor Swift, it can be transform seemingly dry concepts into a love story. As much as Hegenis loves economics, she understands that students don't inherently share that fascination. The history of economics and economic theory, at least the way that it's taught in schools, is all about the number of widgets and supply and demand curves. And those things can be very abstract and not interesting, she says. But showing students how the interplay between the NFL and Swift is an example of the theory of the firm. And looking at Swift's career and success as a means of understanding gender economic discrimination, it can make these concepts more meaningful to students. For me, it's really sad if we don't take advantage of this moment to really help students find a connection between things that they care about and economic theory, Hegenis says. Of course, students' passion, obsession with the Swift. With Swift can be good fodder for a wide range of topics and the perfect way to fill any blank spaces in your curriculum. And you can encourage diversity. Using Swift to make connections with topics as varied as tech and finance for students can have a long-term impact as well. One of the biggest selling points linking economic theory to pop culture moments is that you make the economics more meaningful and relatable for students, Agnes says. In doing that, you probably encourage a wider range of students to be interested in the field and in studying economics. And you don't need to calm down. We know that economics is a field is always struggled to increase diversity within the career pipeline, she says. One of the ways in which we can try to make some effort towards increasing diversity within the field is to teach economics in a way that feels meaningful and relatable to a wider swath in the community. And it's easy since the materials already exist. Hegenis Swiftonomics 101 is available online and can be used as a whole, or as teachers can grab specific videos or lessons. The basic version focuses on the theory of the firm as its core level, she says. The course offers more advanced lessons in the economics of discrimination through the lens of gender discrimination. I call it choose your own adventure curriculum that teachers can just adapt to the needs of their kids and their preferences, Hegenis says. The class is geared towards students from high school and up, and it is an obvious fit for economics teachers, but can be used in classes covering other topics. The material is put together in a really relatable way that is accessible, even if people haven't studied economics, Hegenis said. I would encourage teachers of civics classes, social studies classes, business classes, whatever it might be, just explore the material. Share your experience like it's karma. Hegenis believes that teachers are leaders in their fields and can do more to share their expertise with the world. Making pop culture connections can be a perfect, fearless way to do that, especially for teachers who are also engaged in research. To the extent that we all observe these types of examples in pop culture and in modern culture, we easily see an interpretation through our own academic or theoretical lens, it feels like we owe it to the larger society to impart that knowledge, she says. As a bonus, teaching in this way may not completely fulfill your wildest dreams, but can also serve as a recruitment tool for your subject area. That's probably one of the best ways that we can get a student interested in our own research, and it definitely is a good way to to grow a field, Hegenis says. Finally, have fun. Using Swift as an inspiration for teaching different subjects can simply provide happiness for both teachers and students. And you can never forget the benefit of making class more enjoyable, engaging, and dare we say, enchanted. Sometimes when we're thinking about education and thinking about how we impart knowledge, we can have a tendency to get a little bit lofty with it, Hegenis says. I think we need to give ourselves grace and be willing to incorporate fun and novelty into the way that we teach, because at this end of the day, at the end of the day, that not only makes us better teachers, but it makes students better learners. So now I know what I'll be sharing out to my economics and business teachers in an email coming soon.
It could go in your three things, Susie.
Yeah, I could go in my three things.
Yeah.
I might check it out myself.
That's great.
Thank you for
All right.
indulging me.
Oh no. That's the why I laughed earlier when you started talking about that other article that starts with five. I thought you were starting it on this one.
No.
All right. Well, thank you to you, Susie Brooks, and thanks everybody who stuck with us through this episode of The Breakdown. I hope you found it useful. a lot of great stories in the news around education trends and some great ideas. And you can find a link to all of those on k12leaders.com/the breakdown. I'm sorry, k12leaders.com/breakdown.
Breakdown. We're
And
gonna get it right one of these days.
we'll post a link both on our news feed and out to the other socials as well. And would love to hear your voice.
All right,
Thanks, Susie. We'll talk to you tomorrow.
sounds good. Thanks for listening.